I'm Rowan Moore. I'm the director of the Architecture Foundation, and I work for the Evening Standard about architecture. I'm here to introduce the chairman of the Architecture Foundation. So I'm going to be asking some very, very tough questions.
You wouldn't dream of it.
Later. Will Alsop. Will is one of our... Someone's waving at me. Will is one of our most remarkable architects, and like all the best architects, he's spent a certain amount of his career flirting with not being an architect at all, or certainly not building much. I think as a student, he came very high on the Property Centre competition shortlist, which was of course won by Piano and Rogers. Will paints, Will has taught fine arts, and he did some very provocative schemes for the Riverside Studios in Hammersmith over 20 years ago now. And I, as a student learning architecture, was conscious of this presence called Will Alsop, who was doing very provocative and intriguing drawings. And then we were sort of waiting for something to happen, and then something did happen, which is he won the competition to design the Hôtel du Département in Marseille. And it seemed outrageous, because the way Will went about things was he'd do a painting with kind of splashy paint, and it seemed to be completely out of control. And then, a few years later, these almost abstract, certainly unbuildable shapes would actually suddenly be built in the form of a building costing hundreds of millions of pounds. I think at that point everyone realised that there was something quite exceptional there. But it's still a bit of a mystery how these sort of splashy paintings turn into buildings. But they do turn into buildings, and Will has been applying the technique and developing it, and he's achieved such notable works as the Peckham Library. And most recently he's won the competition to design the Fourth Grace in Liverpool, which is another building which at this current or conceptual phase defies imagination. But I think at this point we should be completely confident that it will happen as promised, but also actually the development of the design, it will turn into something else and it will get even better. There was a conversation about this evening's talk where somebody said, Will said he'd like to talk about aesthetics, and then he said, well, do people at the LSE understand aesthetics? And then Will said, well, if they don't, they ought to. So I'm sure you do, of course, but this is part of Will's mission tonight, to talk about aesthetics. But more particularly, it's about this sort of connection between intense architectural creativity and the life of cities, which is not an obvious connection, but it's undoubtedly there. And a project like the Peckham Library is a case in point. It's a very, very singular, a very, very striking building. It's undoubtedly done a lot for the experience and the perception of Peckham, but how Will's paintings turn into the life of the city is not an obvious process, and I expect him to illuminate some of Will.
Thank you. Before we go on, I don't know if the technician is here, but I will need something to point with. I meant to ask earlier, so if someone could find a pointer or a laser pointer, that would be great. Could you, who are students here, put your hands up, please? Now, I have to admit some sort of ignorance insofar that when you've completed your course here, what do you do then? You're part of a cities program, that I can understand, and you have some great luminaries that assist you and talk to you, and you have a number of very important guests that come and talk to you, and I can understand what they do, but I don't know what you do, really. Do you end up as planners? No? Town centre managers? Relatively new invention, I have to say. What do you do? Does anyone know? Well, sir, I think completely pathetic course here. Pardon? Jolly good. No, I ask because, you see, there are, and I do have to, well, something will come out maybe later or not, but I'll bring some of it out now. I do have to admit that relatively recently I've been doing a lot of work in the north of England, and therefore I'm in a good position to compare it with the south of England. And it seems to me that I like the north of England because there are all sorts of levels of interference that don't exist there that exist here. And I'm coming to the conclusion, in some ways, that that notion that sort of notion of over-management, which is not quite the right word, maybe doesn't do the best for the towns and cities that we occupy and we're trying to make life better in. And maybe it's my ignorance, but maybe some of you are destined for a future in those sort of layers of management that I'm talking about. And I hope for your sake that you're not. I mean, one of those layers, which you're not, certainly, are planners. Some of you might go on to develop that sort of interest, and that would be fine. But they are, with some notable exceptions, and certainly not my experience in, say, some foreign cities like Hamburg, planners have no aesthetic judgment whatsoever. And yet they profess, and they lecture to me and others, of course, and they say, this is not good enough, or this is, they use words like context and color and scale in a very learned way, but actually highly unintelligent. And when I look at really what we've achieved, and I think that certainly the United Kingdom is lucky enough to have some very good architects practicing or trying to practice in this country, that at the end of the day, if I walk around the streets and I look at the buildings that are built, sadly there are very few. Certainly the number of interesting and what I would consider good buildings, and there are some that others consider as good buildings which I might not, but that's, you know, some effort, some engagement, something beyond the mere act of building. There is something that turns building into architecture, and they are not the same thing in my view. It's pathetically few compared with the number of rather good architects and designers that we have, and I wonder why that is, that the way that we can possibly deny that talent, why should we do that? I don't want to hate you when you get older, so please don't make me. Anyway, I thought, against Ricky Burdett's command to me on Monday night on the telephone, that I'd talk about what I wanted to talk about in much the same way that you want to do whatever you want to do. And I just want to take a little snapshot, and I don't want to talk to you for very long, really about how things come into existence. Because I think it's important, just in case you do become a planner, that you know the sort of things that we go through. And I shall start off, and one of the images is behind me, with some work I was doing with Bruce McLean, as I've done almost every summer in Menorca for the last 10 years or so. Ooh, that's interesting. Now, to find that perfect. These things develop a sense of a mind of their own, don't they? It will come, I'm sure. There we go. Let's be quick. Now, one of the things I'd like to say to you is that I don't think we have enough holidays. And for Americans, I think you definitely don't have enough holidays. And I think that the lack of holidays, and particularly in the, I suppose, probably post-1979, and particularly for young accountants and would-be solicitors and things, and people working in the financial world, they're completely overworked as young people. They're exploited, they have few holidays, they have to ask to go out for permission to go. My young niece, I had to take her out to the theatre and for dinner, and she has to ask for permission for that. And she was told, yes, of course you can go out with your uncle, but you must be prepared to come back after dinner, which is 11:30, whatever that is. I think that is totally absurd. We do not want people that are obsessed with what they do. We want people that can balance a good day's work with a good day's reflection of work or enjoyment or social engagement. These things are important. I'm showing you these pictures, and you notice the extraordinary coordination of me painting a white shadow in a white T-shirt and Bruce painting a black shadow in a black T-shirt. Highly planned. But these things are apropos of nothing, so. And it's a part, I think, an increasingly important part of the process, that when on holidays, when taking extended time away from the studio in London, one can indulge in something else. And I think that's an incredibly important aspect of trying to find and discover buildings. And I can say this because for the first time, I think, in architectural history, there is no predominant style or theory. You can do whatever you like. And that might sound easy. It is actually very difficult to do that. It is not. It is actually the rules, often created by architects themselves, that actually make for rather dull buildings, because you simply apply the buildings. And certainly when I used to teach architecture in a number of different institutions in America, you found that young professors would actually turn up, and of course they wanted to go up the food chain, and they had to write, if they could be published, that was all right, and that would help in that endeavor. And they would publish endless books on the methodology of design. First do this, then do that. You know, and it's like poor old Corbusier, you know, who is blamed for saying that form follows function. Didn't really say that in a prescriptive manner. I think that these things are not necessarily true. They might be true for a person or a small group of people, but they're not true for everyone. I think it's very important to remember that if there are no predominant rules that we are supposed to follow, then there is, by implication, no particular rules that can be used in judgment as to what we do from an aesthetic point of view. That's not shirking one's social responsibilities, or financial responsibilities, or political responsibilities, or any of those things which are important, or issues of sustainability. They're all things that, as a decent person, one would be thinking about and worrying about. But they all exist within a context. There's nothing that annoys me more than architects who actually justify their design because it is sustainable. It should be sustainable anyway. Be like someone, when plumbing was first invented, justifying their design because you can see all the plumbing and it's nicely arranged or something, and this building has plumbing. One, we expect buildings to have plumbing these days, there's nothing special about it, and we expect buildings to perform environmentally properly as far as we can. There are some economic arguments in there, and so that usually good practice from an environmental point of view costs more than bad practice, and that's an issue that needs to be dealt with probably somewhere else. But it is true. So we all make the right noises, but we realize the wrong things. But this platform that we made, it's important to make these things yourself, not to have an assistant, although we do have one. I don't know whether he's gone by. Oh, that's my daughter. It requires some rules. The rules are simple. Start at 7 in the morning, finish at 10:30. Have a jolly good breakfast, not too big, because you also want to leave time for a jolly good lunch. Then you have a bit of swimming, then you have a bit of sleeping, and then at the magic gin and tonic hour, at about 6 o'clock, you start again until it's dark. Now, the way that we use our days is also a design issue, I think. What you do within that period that is ordered is clearly up to us. Oh yes, look, there's Bep. He's a very strong man, and he makes sausages when he's not helping us. This thing is provocative. You begin to discover things within it simply by playing with it. I think the notion, like these shadows, for example, and one can begin to develop that, and they become more and more interesting. Architects are always thinking about shadows and overheating of buildings, everything else, and we normally put this brise-soleil on. They all look the same. Have you noticed in the new buildings? They all look the same, and it's all some excuse simply to evolve some aesthetic which came from somewhere else. Or you're just applying something that is actually a standard product. And there's no need for that. You can, even within today's rather tight and ungenerous budgets, you can do all sorts of things. If you try hard, you have to work at it. Probably lose money doing it, but so what? At least you end up with something rather better. As I said, I've worked with Bruce for a long time, and Bruce is not an architect, but actually, and I'm not an artist. But I don't think of him as being either thing. He's a good friend, someone I trust, someone I respect, and I hope the same is true the other way around. You know, which exposes, I think, you know, there's been over a long time now, huge interest in artists working with artists. And always the possibility has been there, of course, and it's been going on and off for much longer than the last 20 or 30 years. Much of it is overmanaged, which destroys the relationship. It can only be there. And the opportunity of expanding that vocabulary and actually using some notion of, I don't like the word creativity, it's a sort of providence of God, but you know what I mean. That there is always the possibility of finding something new, largely destroyed when someone, I don't know where and when, decided that architecture was a science rather than an art. And as a result of that, certainly in this country, many of the architectural schools and the art schools, which often occupied the same buildings or adjacent buildings, were moved apart and therefore ensured for a long time that artists would not meet architects and vice versa. And I think that was a very regressive step, actually. Because although there is a science within architecture, in reality, thank God that's finished, in reality, you're very rarely allowed to use it. There are things like condensation, which are very important to understand, I think. Condensation that actually appeared in many of the buildings that were built post-war as housing using system building, much of which was created, the systems created by cowboys full of corruption, and the buildings fell down and people fell ill and disgruntled and behaved badly. And now we had to rebuild them. Complete waste of money. And they were often sold in the name of not only cost, but being a scientific advance. It's a scandal. Of course, who gets the blame? The architects. It's not our fault. I wasn't around, of course, so I certainly don't get the blame. These shapes, these particular forms in this one, were also of interest to both Bruce and of particular interest to me. So I just wanted you to retain the idea of shadow and the idea of these sort of cardboard forms. Those ones in particular. And then we move to Wakefield. I didn't get my pointer, did I? No. It's always difficult, isn't it? If I stand here, can you hear me just as well?
How long is that?
Oh, it's even longer. I might need that later. This is Wakefield. I'm sure you recognise it. The River Culver, which goes down in the bend here. And there are two bridges. We'll see more of those a bit later. And one's an old bridge, and one's a rather new bridge. The old bridge, of course, is rather beautiful, and the new bridge is rather horrible. And the traffic engineers made an interesting sort of knot here, totally incomprehensible and totally destructive, dividing this area of rather, there's some extremely beautiful old warehouses here, and some knocked down. And actually, there are quite a number of artists that are already using these spaces as studios and other sort of what we can describe as artisans.
There's some big sheds over here, like what we see everywhere. And Turner once sat here and painted a picture of downtown Wakefield, which is to the north of this particular image, which is literally north as we're looking at it. I don't think Turner would sit there today. And there was a French artist, which you might know, Marianne, who painted almost the same picture, but in a different style, also of Wakefield. Wakefield has a very beautiful skyline and was enjoyed and recognized by a number of different artists, and Turner in particular. Now, Wakefield has two railway stations. It's very confusing. You don't know which one to go to. And anyway, once you've got to either of them, you don't go hardly anywhere. No, that's not true. Westgate does go to London. But this area, which is industrial, of course, along the river, there's a weir up here, shortcut for the barges through the lock to take through here. And this would take all sorts of goods down to the other interesting places, like Halifax, and so on and so forth. Or from Halifax, rather, through here, out to the sea. And Fred Curter Kim, has been working much in Wakefield in much the same way that he's been working in Barnsley, to actually try and establish a new future for Wakefield. Wakefield has, in the middle of it, a nighttime economy, which is composed almost exclusively of young ladies wearing almost nothing in January. The net effect of that, of course, is that middle-aged people, like myself, actually I exclude myself because I have been there, and more particularly the elderly people, don't go into Wakefield at night. So that excludes a whole level of restaurants and other facilities and theatres because people won't go in because they feel threatened. In fact, it's not dangerous at all, but it's perceived to be dangerous. So that's one problem. The traffic engineer is perhaps a bigger problem, who has successfully carved up Wakefield in a totally unimaginable way. And the third problem in Wakefield is that they have a very difficult council. One thing that Wakefield has amongst it is an art gallery. And the art gallery in Wakefield is in an old doctor's Victorian villa. We can move on here, actually. There's the bridge. Of which they can only show 3 or 4% of the collection of work that they have. And they have a magnificent collection, mainly 20th century. And someone, or a series of people in Wakefield, clearly had an extraordinary eye. They didn't have a lot of money to spend, but they bought very intelligently certainly in the middle decades of the 20th century. And they're rapidly trying to catch up and have all decades properly represented, and as indeed the beginning of the 21st century. It's the gallery where Hockney would go as a boy, and it's one of the places that he freely admits that inspired him to go on and develop his own artistic talents. And it's a terrible place, actually, apart from the art. So they would like to build a new gallery. And one of the things about this gallery is that it will benefit a gift from Barbara Hepworth's original plaster cast, because Barbara Hepworth was born in Wakefield, and therefore there's a strong link. And of course there's also the strong connections from this area with Henry Moore, and there's the Henry Moore Sculpture Park, rather close to Wakefield, which is rather beautiful if you haven't been there. So, on the edge of the Calder River, this is the site. It's a rather ill-defined site, could be anything. So you start to sketch, see, and I became interested in certain things like optical illusions, whether you can actually create a three-dimensional object which is actually two-dimensional. You can ask me why. You'll notice a number of naked ladies in here because that always stimulates me as I go. And the notion of a box, a great repository for art. I clearly don't know what I'm doing, but you don't worry about it, because it's only by doing this, it's not a prescription,
There is no brief for this building, apart from the art collection itself and a notional sort of sum of money. These are the determining factors.
The building has the advantage of being by the river, and the advantage of these warehouses, some of which are rather beautiful, particularly that one. Something which I had worked out that roughly that sort of size of a single volume could comfortably house the collection. Here you see the old bridge, and the chapel. This is where Turner sat here. There's the mirror, there's the new bridge, and here is the side.
So these things go backwards and forwards. You start with one notion, begin to develop it, forget it, do something else, and go back. Oh, look, this is the shop in the existing gallery. Sort of inspired a shop, wouldn't it? It's even worse. This is the education room. I don't think Hockney was in there, do you? And this is part of the storage. There's the curator. That's me, feeling utterly exhausted, as you can see, having looked at the other 97% of the museum in this storage. And here's the site, the weir. And of course, it's very, to be by water is always appealing. What you also have to recognize is that this piece of water floods significantly, and that there is no land at all. So the site, actually, on occasion, doesn't exist. Always a useful thing.
And I found this, the idea of the circle. Yeah, the idea, perhaps, of making what you might call an infrastructural gallery. But actually, because of Fred Curtin working, well, he's working with the town as a whole, but he's particularly working on a master plan for this area, for workshops and housing, etc., which I suspect will go into the east of this road. Connections back through to the town centre. You do not want to walk over this new bridge. It's not comfortable. There's too much traffic. And could you actually create a gallery with three entrances where you walk through the gallery to get from A to B or wherever you want to go? So it becomes a useful sort of shortcut. I've always been in part inspired by Cedric Price, who I used to work for. And I always remember, he probably forgets he said this, he said, you know, the problems with cities is you have to walk around buildings. And to a certain extent, that's true. If you walk from A to B, it would be very efficient. And never sure, I mean, that's why a lot of my things are on legs, because you can walk under them, of course. But it's one of those things which has always lodged in the back of my mind forever. So I was interested in this circle. I was interested in the idea, perhaps, of also, well, if you then go back to these other aspects, keep looking back at the place and visiting it again, and still sort of struggling on with this idea that you've got the sun in the south and the views to the north. You see, I was getting really bored. And then you remember the work that you've been doing with Bruce in the summer. And slowly, that's part of the collection in Wakefield, the ceramic by Bruce. Again, you get hooked on some small things. They have a rather good collection of modern ceramics. That a sort of concrete wall with concrete shelves as an integral part of the wall with ceramics on it would be very beautiful, casting the shadow. And what could you put on that sort of south side of the building that wouldn't be damaged? And still this notion of parallel walls, it's an old idea which I often go back to, if in doubt, go back to something that you already know, and where you can create this sort of green bridge across, another link. And these sort of connections between the light and the dark side. But then ultimately return to the circle. And to examine that circle in different ways. Is it one circle? Is it a roof and a floor? What is it? No. Here's getting slightly closer. You get to this, which is a sort of three-dimensional mirror strip. So that I was interested in this because if the black is glass, you can create this solid element on this facing south. I always get this wrong around, it doesn't really matter. But you get the idea that as the thing twists,
you can always have the shade on the south side, no matter which part of the circle that you're in. So then you begin to think, well, we'd be very interested in the gallery to have no electricity at all. See, I'm appalled that all this special lighting in galleries costs a fortune. You think, well, that's very necessary. But on the other hand, I remember once being in the Kunsthalle in Hamburg on a dull day when the lights failed, the electricity failed. Suddenly I saw these paintings, and indeed sculpture, with normal daylight, rather dull daylight, coming through windows. I thought, this work looks terrific. You know, and I went back the next day to have another look, and on a sunny day, I mean, the lights were back on, but nonetheless, you could see that these works take on different characters according to the quality of the light. And the majority of people that go to the galleries, of course, tend to be local. They're the people that you want to come back. They're the people that you want to see, them to see it early in the morning, late in the evening, on a dull day, on a sunny day, etc., etc. And you'd save a lot of money. So you have, there's one set of people that are trying to, that they try and balance a degree of natural light with artificial light. So you always see the work under the same light condition. Who invented that? Why is it such a good idea? Doesn't seem very good to me. So to have a gallery with no electric points would be magnificent, wouldn't it? Well, I think it would. And when it gets dark, gallery closes, that's fine. It's open long hours in the summer, and not very long, particularly in Wakefield, in the winter. But you can begin to see, as I've been working away on this, think, well, how do you make the strip and what is it? And you come back to the platform shape from Minorca, which of course, from a structural point of view, is rather good to make this break loop. And of course, within the break loop, you're encompassing some land and some water, and on occasion, all water. And this has to be elevated. People think that I always do things on legs because it's something willful. I normally find there is good reason, and particularly here. And then the skin of this, which is also a sort of structural, triangulated structure, then actually revolves and is suspended in different ways from this very rigid structural element. And then, of course, when you look at it, there's the L shape, so there's the thing going around, and here is the infrastructural gallery. All the things that are not a part of the gallery, like the lavatories, there will be a shop, there will be somewhere to get a drink, and can bolt onto the back of the wall. So you maintain a very pure passage around, so you can stand sculpture on the floor, but work on the walls. That's more or less where we've got to on that at the moment. There you can see it in location, capturing both water and land. Slightly move the entrances to more useful locations in response to Fred Curtis' master plan. There you have it in section, standing on the legs, partially on land, partially on water. Then you look at what you've done or where you've got to, and you think, where does this stuff come from? You know, why is it that I find this image interesting? A year ago, I wouldn't have done. I don't like these things very much, but it serves a point. At this juncture, I then decided to do a competition in Singapore, which I didn't win, but it was interesting for a new art school in Singapore. I mean, very interested in this notion of these donuts and these circles and these rigid structural elements and the way that they part. So you. This is a fantastic pointer, huh? Thank you. So where they come apart, you have external space. Now in Singapore, of course, you can then encourage wind to go through here to sort of aerate it a bit. So, of course, in other climates, of course, you can then use it as external areas. So you begin to develop something which encloses inside. You can imagine there is a space which is public space. So again, people can walk through the art school, be exposed to various exhibitions and so on and so forth, and out the other side. It's a part that this academic institution becomes a part of the ordinary person's like as they go about their daily business. And I think that's not a bad objective. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I'm just saying how these things are traced through from one thing to another. You can see that this particular lady is a bit ambivalent towards this proposal, but this one loves it. And that takes me straight to Liverpool. Liverpool, for the fourth grace, and I'm sure there are some people that know Liverpool, there are these three buildings. I'm not sure they're always called the three graces, actually, but anyway, they are today. And there is a gap at the end. And it is a magnificent waterfrontage, and it reflects the past glories of Liverpool. It was an extremely rich city at one time. It has, in other ways of looking at it, it was a place, the Welsh and the Scots and the Irish often call it the only Celtic city in England, because that's where they all left or arrived, and many departed never to bless these shores again from more or less this place. And these three magnificent buildings, the Liver building in particular, the one with the Liver birds on top, is actually technically quite a radical building when it was first built. Built by a failed architect from the School of Architecture. And the Liver birds themselves were some sort of rude gesture back to the school. But anyway, that's another story. At the end of this reception is, well, you can't quite see it here, but there's a car showroom. There's rubbish, a bit of parking. It doesn't hang together at all. And in this gap between this building and the Maritime Museum and the Albert Dock, which houses the Tate of the North, it really is a disgrace. And the Maritime Museum do take over and have events in this landscape, but it doesn't work, you can't circulate around it properly, and it really is not a part of the city. And the other thing, for those of you that don't know Liverpool, is that the area in front of these three buildings is grass. It is one of the most manicured dog's lavatories, possibly in the world. You don't go there because it's characterized by horizontal rain because of the wind. It is not a friendly spot. That somebody in their landscape design had an idea, and what a rotten idea it was. It's from the river, three graces, and then this gap of nothingness here before the Albert Dock starts over here. My way. This is Scribble. I like Scribble because it's something that you can do which is not determined, and there are possibilities within it. It's looking down on the site. I'm just taking you through a part of the process. It was a two-stage competition. In the first stage, I didn't take much notice because I thought Liverpool was fraught with difficulties. There's no real value in Liverpool, although it is coming up. Politically, it's hard, and nothing will happen, even if you do win. But then we got into the last stage against three other architects, and I began to take it seriously, and changed everything, of course. And that's when you begin to sketch, and you begin to try and find, much as with Wakefield, through sketching possibilities. And I arrived at this one. The way that to do this is it's three-dimensional scribble. So I can make a line, then I can extrude a square around that line. And hey presto, you get a form. I mean, you keep doing this, and I did lots of them. Well, I was interested in this one insofar that if you can imagine the end of the three graces coming here, some connection through over the strand, which is this terrible road that separates Liverpudlians from their waterfront. And having some of that forms an edge here, and you've got an umbrella. You've also got a wind tunnel, incidentally, but then we'll worry about that later. That could be interesting. What would it... If you apply the scribble to the scribble, you get a different sort of texture. I don't know what that little dollop on the right is, but say I love you. And you begin to think about the program a bit. And what I liked about this competition is the program was very open. There would be public money put into this project, quite a large sum of public money, but there was also private money. And we were able to balance these two. And we were the ones that actually selected our own private sector partners to do this and molded not only the architecture, but the whole deal into something that was deliverable by putting the right team together. But it is also very apparent that this thing, their title, the Fourth Grace, should actually be essentially a very public building. That it should not be seen to be something that is supplying a part of the money to pay for itself. Therefore, there was an early decision to separate the residential, which overlooks the water, but is furthest away from the water, away from the Fourth Grace proper. Therefore, you know, the whole of this thing is not the Fourth Grace. There's an aspect of it that is. And that will contain a museum, inevitably. But again, the NMGM, which I always forget what it stands for, they have an extraordinary collection of stuff concerned with the history of Liverpool, which is all in a warehouse somewhere. There will be a hotel, because I think, interestingly, hotels are public space in a way. There will be a gallery space, and I can't say more than that at the moment about that. And there will be, on top of this building, a public space again. So the ground floor is devoted absolutely to the public, and the very top of the building is actually also a space. And the space, as I describe, we call the Liverpool Lounge. And that the Liverpool Lounge is where you're encouraged to go and do absolutely nothing, which I think would be very refreshing. It's what I don't like about the magazine Time Out, is actually time in, isn't it? You go out to go in. It's not about occupying the streets. It's about occupying a cinema or a club or whatever it is. It takes people off the streets. And it's always to go and do something. Always do spending money. I think it would be good to have some places in the city where you don't have to spend anything, but it's a very enjoyable place to be. So having refined this scribble, having had a bit of a chat with Arabs, you can see that the form of this building is evolved. And the form, hey presto, this being the Fourth Grace proper, this being the two towers because of the accommodation. A new ferry terminal here. But this is the world, or a potential future World Heritage site. This waterfront. Who allowed the existing ferry terminal to be built? It is revolting. Completely a terrible way. And arriving by water to this place could be a very important part of the whole experience. Anyway, moving on to that. Moving the ferry terminal from this location, so actually distorting the land. And therefore, this is the Fourth Grace. More or less in line with the existing three, more or less of a similar scale to the existing three, although they in themselves vary from one to the other. If you look at the section, by distorting the landscape, lifting up here, become very central, new very central, liberated towards this certain landscape style, you can now, which British Waterways wants to do a special kind of one, to do more or less two or so, then having it down, that's what I'll do, push down again, and then actually it forms a hill here, which then houses the new museum accommodation. Actually, what I'm trying to do as of working on this morning, trying to take some of that accommodation up into this column. And then there are three donuts, one on top of the other. So it takes you straight back to LaSalle in Singapore, which in turn comes from Wakefield, which in turn comes from Malagava in Menorca. And there are sort of I should have gone on to describing that. There are then connections over and under the Strand, and potential connection to the underground station. So try to create a place that is not only draws people to it for different reasons, but also you can get to. And this is the view from the river. apologise for that, I forgot that was here. And here you can see how it blends into the existing waterfront. You're allowed to laugh at that. Of course it blends. This is what we won't do on the inside. We always get sort of trapped into trying to explain something that before you have to explain it, really, before you know really what it is.
So, not to make a glass building. In fact, this building will be quite solid. And it will be a melange of different, quite difficult materials. I don't know exactly what. There will certainly be some rusted steel. Leather, quite like leather. And glass. And then, as you go up the building, just like in the art school itself, there are bits where it separates. So these are external spaces. But because of the wind, then there is a ribbon that goes around, a bit like sort of Escher's drawings of the unraveled, but like the bandaged face. And they give wind protection, and therefore giving a longer use to those external spaces you have to put on top of the Liverpool lounge. And then we're back to where we started. Now, I've probably talked long enough, haven't I? Yes. Mars. I was just going to show you, if I may, it's a very short DVD about Liverpool, which does have sound, but we're not wired up for sound here, because someone's broken the connection between here and there. But it doesn't matter. Let's see if I can... I'm always surprised if when these things work. Oh, it's mine. Look promising, didn't it? If it doesn't work this time, I'll give up. Oh, I see.
Liverpool is not just a city in Europe. Liverpool is a city of international significance. Liverpool is a city with global ambitions. From its earliest days, Liverpool has attracted people from other places. People with an appetite for the new and the different. People with the courage to travel and explore. Risk takers, pioneers, inventors. This is what the fourth grid should represent. Up to now, the Liverpool waterfront has felt separate from the city centre. We propose to stretch a pier from the Mersey, through James Street, all the way to Derby Square. No more Strand to cross, and you arrive at the waterfront from an elevated position. A new freedom. The fourth grace gives us the opportunity to embrace a new transport interchange at the pierhead. A sheltered place to wait at any time of day. A new ferry terminal. A canal. A station for future Mersey tram. A space for cycles, buses, taxis and coaches. An underground connection to James Street station. The whole all of Merseyside will benefit from this. The hill is a new landscape, an elegant promontory from which to view the river. A 24-hour space for the city, open to anybody to use any time. In the hill, you will find permanent exhibition space for the collection of the National Museums and Galleries of Merseyside, a space for visiting exhibitions from the UK and internationally, a 500-seat auditorium, a multi-purpose venue for Merseyside from conventions to weddings, shops, bars, restaurants, a place for the everyday. The three graces are the international symbols of Liverpool. All three reflect Liverpool's success as a port and its willingness to demonstrate that success by investing in the best buildings. In their time, they were considered bold, innovative and pioneering. They have set the standard by which its new neighbours should be judged. The fourth grace, like a cloud hovering over the hill, represents the 21st century equivalent, bold, innovative and pioneering. This proposal is not considered in isolation. It connects the Albert Dock with the Four Graces by introducing the NMGM Exhibition Park. In line with the nomination for the Liverpool Waterfront World Heritage Site, the park tells the story of Liverpool through the historic landscape in and around the Graving Docks, museum as promenade. The icon of this new place is the cloud, articulated with hieroglyphics of Liverpool's 800 years of history. Visually changing as you move around it, it invites people inside like an inverted tornado. Inside the cloud, three nebulous rings of accommodation stack on top of each other. Within the rings, 10 ever-changing floors give the impression of constant rotation. A circling route takes you from the heart of the hill to the top of the cloud. From the museum reception, you will pass through a convention centre, workspaces, a hotel, bar and cafes, and an international gallery, culminating in the new Liverpool Lounge, a viewing platform for all to enjoy, a new panoramic vista of Liverpool. We would like to make this dream a reality. Many people say that to understand Liverpool, you have to approach it from the Mersey. The RSOC Consortium wants to give Liverpool the edge. A garden of light that stitches together with a waterfront from Prince's Dock to King's Dock. Alongside the three graces, the fourth grace will unify the gateway to Liverpool. Bold, innovative and pioneering.
Example of the beginning of the process is Bilbao Guggenheim. And this sort of phenomenon of icons is possibly a debasing currency, because if everyone has one, and they don't become so special. So then the question becomes, how do you discriminate between icons? What makes an extraordinarily shaped building good or bad? Because that's obviously the case. Some of these extraordinarily shaped buildings are very good, some are not very good. And maybe what people find about threatening about Will is that those people who do find it threatening, which doesn't include me, is that he gives them no framework for judging buildings. So I want to ask Will, how do you know when an extraordinarily shaped building is genuinely extraordinary, is genuinely good, or when is it just an empty gesture?
Thank you. I think I'd have to take issue with you in a very friendly way, that the idea of the iconic building, I don't think that that was an architectural invention of the word. That was invented by journalists, critics, or whatever. And it's a recognition of an effect that happened because a piece of architecture came first and created that. What I would say is that I think that St. Paul's is pretty iconic. York Minster, Durham Cathedral, these were very special buildings that had a particular function at the time. And in that way, they are no different. And who knows what Wren would have done if it had titanium and modern technology today. So I think that in many respects, and certainly there are better examples than that in the past, where architects and designers have tended to push the technology of the day and end up with something extraordinary. But I think what is common to all is that they all are about a rich experience. And I think it was very interesting in Berlin that arguably Danny Lichkin's Jewish Museum was more interesting without the content. And it certainly attracted a lot of people to go in and explore it and enjoy that space. That pure space can be an attraction if it's carefully honed. Then you can add things to it or not. So your actual question is, how do you know when you've reached that point? And I think that that's an almost impossible question to answer. I think you know within yourself. It's asking a sculptor, how do they know when to stop? Right? And you don't always know. Sometimes you just stop. And I think that's as valid as making some decision. Inevitably, I think within architecture, there are stopping points which are determined by all sorts of things like deadlines, past. And certainly on the fourth gross, I think there is an open debate about some of the, the precise nature of the functions. I mean, which we've already started, I say, with the museum staff. We're working, what is, for example, a museum that deals with the life, the past life of the city? And I'm very intrigued at the moment, saying, well, there are 500,000 people in Liverpool. And given the size of the museum, which is roughly 15,000 square meters, you could make an individual museum for every person, couldn't you? They could have 0.33 of a square meter to actually address. And in a way, you can begin to have this sort of evolving museum, this evolving archive. It's very interesting. It appeals to people's sense of nosy quality that they have. And how do you deal with this vast array of stuff that they have, ranging from steam engines down to beautiful, very small objects, down to 10,000, or not 10,000, many thousands more than that, of historic photographs, all of which have different meanings to different people. How would you select that? And I was rather intrigued by the idea that the curators don't, that you might invite artists to make installations from the collection, from the warehouse, in certain spaces, so that the different ways of using the space to actually always try and take it away from the expected, I think is very important, particularly important. Well, I think it's important anywhere. But it's that sort of ambition, which is the same as the ambition in terms of form and shape of the building. It's something that drives you forward. You're looking for new things. And as I said at the beginning, if you don't feel that it's appropriate to conform to the predominant architectural style or manners, it is very difficult. You have to find it in another way.
Is one of the factors, the ongoing maintenance, the cost of running the building and all that kind of thing, or is this just not part of his brief?
Those factors are always in your mind, and there are always issues that come up in various ways at various times. I think that certainly on something like the fourth grace that I was showing, that there are some maintenance issues which I have yet to address. But I have the confidence I can overcome those, of course. But have no fear, by the end of the process, they are dealt with.
This wonderful fluid process of yours that evolves and evokes a building from leaps of imagination. I think it's very important when you, in terms of the interface with the city, to recognize time and the sustaining of the speed of imagination and the response time that can happen when you're standing in front of a painting, and the time it takes to make a building of the fourth grace, which is measured in years rather than measured in minutes. And I think it'd be helpful to try and understand how you bridge that, those different time parameters.
The response to a particular place in a particular city, of course, is varied. And I think that I'm very interested in Liverpool because it has been out in the wilderness for so long in itself. Extraordinary history as a whole. Actually, in 2008, it will celebrate its 800th anniversary, so it's been there a long time. It's been through many transformations. And I'm intrigued by the idea of a city that actually has been pretty stagnant for a long time, particularly when you compare it with Manchester, which is not very far away, which has transformed itself, particularly over the last 10 to 15 years. And why is that, and what are those processes? So that when you deliberately, I took a decision that in Liverpool, we should place a building which actually is unlike any other building you have seen. There's a huge sort of catch-up, this sort of notion that there's something that actually represents the separation between the last thing that was built of any sort of significance and something new. And I think that it has to become symbolic in that way. I think there are other cities. I mean, as I said, it was competition, and there are deficiencies in competition. It makes it difficult to talk. And for example, in some of you might be aware of the work I've been doing in Barnsley, a well-known Tuscan hill town, that I spent a lot of time working with people of Barnsley in order to fashion and mould a possible future for that town. And it seems to me that if you spend the time, and this is why I find it difficult to answer your question, because there will be these sorts of events which will begin to influence certain aspects of Liverpool. As you introduce the sort of public dimension, if you work with people in a very, I think I work with people, it's not formally, it's known as public consultation. Now, public consultation is amongst one of the most boring activities in the world, both for me and the public, I would say. But if you approach it in another way, it's not boring, and there's only one rule I have in these sort of what we might call more creative sessions, and that is no one's allowed to say no. You can say yes or nothing. And if it's a silence, you know that you probably don't go any further. But the most extraordinary thing I find is people, when they expose themselves to each other, they actually break down other barriers, and people are very much more creative, ambitious, than we give them credit for. And certainly the planning process and that form of public consultation doesn't allow for it. Therefore, I'm saying that the whole process, in my mind, is about discovering what the architecture wants to be. rather than having an idea about architecture, which I think is very dangerous for architects and the general public. And what I'm trying to work towards in my own sort of feeble way is a way that of an inclusive architecture, which doesn't actually, where I can be myself as an individual and take into account other people's dreams and aspirations and try and put some different sort of flesh on. And I think there's some degree of success. I mean, the community arts building in West Bromwich, I've been working on. I mean, I was astounded, having done a lot of work with the locals, and of course it was a perfect client body to work with, because Jubilee Arts have been working with the locals for 25, or now 28 years. And therefore they knew exactly who I should work with and who those people are. But once we've got to a point where we thought we'd discovered what this building should be, we thought that we should talk to the planners. Yes, we would need planning permission at some point. And what was intriguing to me is that I presented it to the planners with probably 15 or 20 of some of the people in the different groups. And you could see that this was not going very well. The planners started to ask some difficult questions. You could certainly see that the planner was not very enthusiastic about it. Whereupon, one of the locals got up and said, "Excuse me, little local. This is our town. It's our money, the majority of the money, the public money. And it's our building. So who are you protecting?" And I thought that was an extremely good question, that you can actually transcend these imagined protection of a public who don't need protecting at all if they're engaged in the right way. And that's what I'm trying to explore. Initially, I suppose it was the CPLEX project that made me begin to think about that. And I suppose more historically, I was always interested in people like Harbrack, and although I didn't really understand it, this notion of determining one's own sense of place, one's own sense of urbanism, was very intriguing. But being able to have the privilege to sort of begin to work on that at different scales, and that's why I find Barnsley particularly interesting, and why it's very direct. I find that Barnsley town itself has a population of, well, let's call it 100,000, but actually feel that you know every member of that town. It takes a long time to walk through the centre of Barnsley, but everyone wants to have a chat about what's going to happen. I've changed my mind about this in about 2 days. There's good humour about it, and it's all wrapped around drinking beer, eating, I have to say, revolting food, but that's the price that you pay. Now, we're just one city of Bradford in a similar way. Bradford's going to be really difficult, and we'll do it in a very different way. I don't know exactly what way we will do it at the moment, except we said that we'd do a 12-month festival of thinking. The fact that they were not shortlisted for the cultural for the city of culture means that we could do the city of culture anyway and discover what the town or the city might become. So it's a very... So time becomes a part of the process, is what I'm trying to suggest. And the moment that the building is actually finished in terms of construction, a good building will then go on to evolve and adapt in ways that we have not yet imagined. And I think that's good.
I like to quote from Cedric Price, and I guess I'd like to add to it and say that for architects it's also hard not just to talk to, I mean, the problem with cities is not just you have to walk around the buildings, but the problem for architects is that it's hard to talk about cities without talking about buildings. And you almost began to do this when you started to talk about time out, and yet that led straight away to talking about Fourth Grace and the Liverpool Lounge, and that would be a place where you could go in the city, straight back inside a building again. I guess I've got two questions in relation to that. First of all, how do you imagine that Liverpool Lounge being a space where you aren't just a, you know, cast in the role of a consumer? And the second question is, your involvement in the art gallery in Wakefield, isn't the art gallery that's the realm of the consumer now today, you know, ahead of any other. Is that not just back to the same problem?
Let me deal with those things in a slightly different way. The Liverpool Lounge, of course, I have yet to design in some sort of detail. It seems to me that, yeah, you should, it's about two things. It's about view, it's about access, and it's about being able to buy a beer or coffee if you want to. And I think that's why, and about some weather protection. You're actually on the upper floor. I didn't show you the plan. You're mainly outside, but there are, it's for obvious reasons, some internal parts as well. And about comfortable seats. I mean, it's one of the aspects of many of our towns and cities, is that it's actually difficult to sit down, because a lot of benches are removed so that vagrants can't sleep on them. Notice that. And it's a very important, it's like the removal of our public lavatories as well. Yeah, what you do for the incontinent, I don't know. But, I mean, it's almost criminal that a good place to sit down with a beautiful view to do nothing, and knowing that you could access a good cup of coffee if you wish to, but not feel obliged to, is something that I think any town or city actually requires. The fact is, in Liverpool, it's at the top of the building. There are opportunities at the bottom of the building as well. And that's why I like the sort of public sandwich. Have you been to Starbucks just to sit down without buying a coffee? Well, it's a place that you can go. I mean, actually, some Victorian piers are like that. You can walk along the pier. And you don't have to, and you can sit down. I suppose you often have to pay for your deck chair, of course, but you don't have to have something to eat or drink, or you don't have to go to the end of the show, do you? I mean, that is a good public gesture. It's terrific. The other bit of your, wait, I didn't understand your question on Wakefield at all, because it's both bridge and gallery, and it's exposing, I hope, in a rather more beautiful way, public collection of work that the town has invested in over quite a long period of time. It's public space. But of course there are security issues. But I don't see where the consumer comes in for that free until the next conservative government gets in. No. You're trying to encourage me to say something else, which I think I have some sympathy with you.
I mean, for example, in talking about Wakefield, I mean, I guess I was more curious with what was happening underneath this Mobius strip. You know,
well,
about those linkages, when you're talking about linkages, you're not linking through the gallery space.
No, it's through the gallery space.
Oh.
It's a bit of a bugger when it's shut. One more.
Yeah. The mechanics are very, very bad. And I'd like to follow up on Cedric said, maybe the answer was building. I was just picking up on the previous question that was talking about Cedric Price. It's clearly an inspiration for Will and for any sentient person in the field of architecture in the last 30 years. But Cedric said that maybe the answer is not a building, and Will seems pretty confident that the answer is a building, and I'd say he's usually proved right. So I'd like to just tease out a little bit more what do you think a building does? What the kind of actual physical fabric of this constructed object does?
It does many things. Cedric's notion of maybe the answer is not a building is in response to thinking about architecture as being a problem-solving activity. And certainly at the end of the 60s, architects discovered Karl Popper, and suddenly they all became problem solvers. And I mean, it's an issue that I take up, that there are useful aspects of that particular view of oneself, and there are completely absurd aspects to it. You know, that if you're a problem solver, then clearly, you know, the way that you would respond to a local authority at that time that wanted to build a, perhaps were interested in building a new swimming pool, you could think about that and you could say, no, why don't you make a rather more frequent and more comfortable bus service to Putney? And in which case, use their swimming pool. And there's one way, and you could do you could do the exercise on capacity. In the end, you know, there might be quite a useful suggestion, but it wouldn't give Hammersmith a beautiful swimming pool. And that's why I have a problem. I mean, I think that there are proper distances between aspects of these things that contain various bits of behaviour, which is another way of saying what a building is, which we have a right to be able to walk to or cycle to, and that there are varying distances which are appropriate. And I was very pleased, I mean, it's the only good thing I could say about the emergence of postmodernism in the middle to late 70s, is that the idea of architecture became an idea about architecture again, and it sort of stumbled towards, I think, where we are today, which I think is a significantly more interesting place, the more interesting debate, with a more interesting range of people doing some things that they really mean to do, and they're not subjected to an idea about really what architecture is. And I'm very pleased that some people do things that I don't like very much, but at least they do it with gusto and with verve. And I think that the Architecture Foundation itself is, I mean, it's well known, trying to represent all these different aspects of architecture, both as an art and as a contributing debate to anything that you're interested in, which is the evolution of the city and the city life, whatever that is. There's a lot of things I can say to your observation. I think that planners I think you have to go back in not very far into history, but there was a time where the chief planner was a very, and clearly you had good ones and you had bad ones, but they were very confident in their judgment, and they would truly advise the planning committee. And I think throughout the from the early 80s onwards, to including today, the chief planner has become someone that actually doesn't advise the planning committee and has left more and more decisions, ultimate decisions, to this band of lay people. I think that's wrong. It's almost as though they're denying themselves an opinion. And where they give advice to a design team for preparing an application, they are really, what they're really doing, if they're not engaging in the conversation about planning and urbanism or architecture, they're engaging in the conversation about what they imagine their planning committee might approve or not. And that's not a very interesting conversation. You're trying to second guess somebody. So if I then compare many of the planners that I meet in different boroughs, say with someone like the Ober Baderent or a chief planner of Hamburg, for example, who is absolutely clear, is passionate about architecture, is passionate about the evolution of their city, is passionate about how to revitalize certain parts of it, which seems to function properly, like the old fishing harbor. You know, how do you go about it? How do you do it? He engages the ears of the politicians. He debates and cajoles with them, and so on and so forth. And it seems to me that's the proper job. Chief planner, in many of the places we have, not all, there are some exceptions, as I say, in this country, and it's not a proper job. It's a stupid job. It's an insult. You know, why would you want to become a planner and have to behave like that? It's not a contribution. But at the same time, these are the planners that actually allow, and they should know better, of course, have allowed the large shed culture to emerge and destroy the very towns that they think they're protecting. It's unforgivable. Some do, some don't. But, I mean, there is another important difference in this, and to do with your question, is you find that the Obadar is in charge of transport, rubbish collection, everything. So that if you're evolving some plan or some project there, he not only has a vision, and he'll debate that vision with your vision, and not going to impose anything on you, but it will be a proper debate. He can control his traffic engineer, unlike many of the planners in this country, where the traffic, it would appear that traffic engineering is a law unto itself, with its own budgets, and do whatever they like, so they can take a very well-honed project for a part of town or a part of a city, and come and destroy that project overnight. Don't know, bigger joke than that. There is no debate. And I think it's lamentable, and very difficult. So while there's one body of people that are trying genuinely to either regenerate, revitalize, rebuild, and also to create new parts of the fabric of this country, there's another lot that actually are more successful in destroying because they're more powerful.
Nonetheless, it seems to be building quite a lot of fabric, which is quite something.
I'm good at shouting.